is Wednesday. Yes, Wednesday, May 27th, 2020. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. And yes, in our ever-expanding podcast empire, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. On today's show, we have got a Raging Chicken interview with Brian Bailey. Bailey is an assistant professor of rhetoric and composition at University of Cincinnati's Blue Ash College. He's got some new articles that are going to be coming out in the coming weeks. And I'm telling you, anything that Brian writes, you should get on because I tell you, I love his work. I love his advocacy. But anyways, the coming weeks, you got Are We an Academic Journal? Editing as Ethical Practice for Change. And that will be coming out in Reflections, a Journal of Community and Engaged Writing and Rhetoric. And that's co-authored with Steve Parks. He's also got the article. So, Richard Spencer. You remember Richard Spencer? The guy who can deserve, well, you know, a little kind of like cock in the jaw every once in a while. That guy, you remember the memes. So you got Richard Spencer coming to college, coming to your campus. How was he allowed on, and how can you confront him? That's coming out soon in Present Tense, a Journal of Rhetoric and Society. I want to talk to Brian today about the ways that COVID-19 is giving cover for the wholesale destruction of public higher education. You know, set our bar low today. How about that? Crazy. Today's first segment, we're going to say, well, what's happening in Ohio University? We talked a little bit about this on our regular podcast every Friday about this kind of like mass layoffs that's going on at Ohio University. But that is just the tip of the iceberg and what's happening kind of across the campus. But this is the best way of setting the tone. Since the beginning of the month, OU has eliminated jobs for at least 340 people, coupled with the retirement of another 88 positions, and 74 of which were faculty members. So those are retired positions that are not going to be filled. Those aren't counted in those cuts. And those cuts have included the layoffs of 53 instructional faculty and the elimination of 149 administrative positions. Most recently, OU announced cuts to 40% of the faculty at the regional campuses. 40%. Just think about that. At a time when people are flooding to regional campuses, they're cutting 40% of their faculty. All these cuts have been done with the cover of COVID-19 pandemic, of course. And it's like Margaret Thatcher's return from the dead to remind us that there's nothing we can do. Well, is this just a force of nature? Or are we seeing disaster capitalism on steroids? And as a little sidebar, we'll say, hey, what's this mean for organized labor, especially organized labor in higher education or attempts to do so? That's a good hang question out there. In today's second segment, so we've got a little something closer to Brian's home. Like I said, Brian is at University of Cincinnati, the Blue Ash College. And we see similar patterns of cut, gut, and punish with one significant difference. Right, while faculty members are discouraged from using the copier for class handouts in the name of saving money, the university has been on a spending spree when it comes to NCAA Division I athletics. According to an excellent investigative report by UC student newspaper, The News Record, records show that while UC had an athletic deficit of $5.6 million in 2005, big money, right? That's funny, right? In 2019, that deficit increased fivefold to $29.7 million. What's that meant for faculty teaching on University of Cincinnati's campuses? Well, we'll ask Brian about that. And UC's budgeting schemes will sound like they come from the same playbook that we see right here in PA State System of Higher Education. Maybe because it is from that same playbook. And in a time when the most vulnerable are most at risk, Ohio's labor laws are double jeopardy for adjunct faculty. Right? And we've talked about this again and again. It's those folks that are on the margins that are going to be impacted the worst, which is where we should be looking for our organizing efforts. And in today's last call, yes, that's right, an interview with a last call. So we're going to look for temporary diversions from COVID-19 and the disaster capitalists to see if we can get Brian to tell us about some beer recommendations. Yeah, some from his neck of the woods, some maybe, who knows? Maybe they're going to come from China. From China. I don't know, but I'm wearing a Rheingeist Brewing hat right out of Cincinnati in his honor today. I want to remind everybody that if we want a progressive future, we need progressive media. You can help support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today. Become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress today and choose your membership level. We're expanding our network as we see today here with the relaunch of our interview programs. We're expanding our network, yes, for the fight of our lives and the fight for the future in 2020. And we're all in for the fight, and now we need you. We're not asking you to break the bank. We're asking you to become a member for the price of a good beer once a month. help make them keep the media in the movement. The movement, the media, become a member for as little $5 a month by going to patreon.com/rcpress today. Well, hey, Brian, man, thank you so much for coming on the show today. And it's just been great talking to you. It's been great to kind of reconnect. I've known Brian for a while now. But, you know, welcome. I wish we had kind of done this under less kind of trying circumstances, but here we are.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, I've known Brian's back. We both kind of came through Syracuse University, kind of connected with some similar folks, especially in the kind of labor movement, in the kind of activist movement within higher education for a long period of time. And then Brian kind of got a job at University of Cincinnati, and I had done my PhD down at Miami University of Ohio, so I kind of knew that neck of the woods. So it's always been kind of a nice little kind of reminder of that area of the country, especially when I get news from Brian. It's been particularly trying right now, though, that we're seeing, you know, what's happening in Ohio is not dissimilar from what we've got going on here in Pennsylvania. And, you know, I mean, I know, Brian, that what's funny about this situation, right, is I think that most of us spend the time in higher education. Again, this is not just higher education. Higher education is not some special bubble area. This is just something that is happening to us, too, as well. Right. And we tend to focus on our individual campus, right, because that's where our jobs are. We're thinking about kind of the students that we're serving. And we're kind of doing this almost hand to hand combat with administrations that are consistently telling us that we need to do more with less, that, you know, the sky is falling, that we're in a crisis. But then we start to see things, what's happening across state lines, across university lines. We start finding out that there's a similar kind of pattern, a similar dynamic. And what I saw was happening at OU this past month, really, it was just kind of like, you know, you get to see something that, I don't know, sticks up above the fog and says like, oh my God, that's happening. Like, and then suddenly you start realizing, no, that's happening all across the state of Ohio, just as it is here in Pennsylvania. So, I mean, given what's going on in Ohio, I mean, give us maybe we can go both back and forth. And so, like, I gave a little bit of introduction what's happening at OU, but what's kind of that the dynamic that's going on both, I say, at OU and then throughout the Ohio system? I mean, is it disaster capitalism writ large, or is this just kind of COVID-19 is, you know, causing us to have to tighten our belts?
Oh, this is absolutely disaster capitalism writ large, and COVID-19 is just a cover to go ahead and do this. Again, as you were saying in your intro there, it's just this idea that the sky is falling, and it's really not. We're talking about most universities, unless they've been completely mismanaged, which we can get into because I can break it down by a couple different campuses. But unless they've been completely mismanaged, they're fine. They're healthy. And so when you talk about OU, what's even more depressing for me, and also something that causes a lot of concern, you know, for those of us who work at the regional campuses within these larger Ohio systems, the Ohio University actually just also cut like 40% of its adjunct faculty at its regional campuses. And actually, I don't even know if it's adjunct because I just saw a letter that came out, an open letter. So I'm not sure with all the different sort of jargon and nomenclature that goes on there, if we're talking only contingent non-tenure track faculty, or if we're talking people on the tenure track or even tenured folks, but outright they have just cut them. And that's really what it is it's the idea that we need to do this because it's a disaster. They're already picking out at these campuses this idea that we're going to have the worst happen. So it's just like Katrina. It's just like anything that would have happened. I believe it was Argentina back in the 70s, right?
Yep.
The idea that, you know, look, this is horrible, and therefore it's time for austerity. And it's not necessarily true because budgets are always values, right? Budgets are fictional. It's a set of values. It's also an ideological worldview. And so what you have is people projecting those values of neoliberalism, of disaster capitalism onto the situation now. And more than anything, because it's a cover, and because I don't think these folks are stupid or misinformed, what they're doing is saying, this is the time to reshape what we want to see at our campuses and what we want to see in our system and how we want to be able to break labor, essentially. We want labor to work in particular ways. We want them scared. And so without that, what ends up happening is you would have a much more concise, let's have three or four different plans, depending on scenarios, and you'd have more shared governance, which is the hallmark of a university system of shared governance. But you're not. You're seeing top-down authoritarian moves that only come when you create an artificial disaster.
Yeah, you know, it's really hard to get people to, and what I should say, not just people, but I could even say some of my colleagues, for example, or people who work at the university, staff members. And, you know, I think students are a little bit more receptive to this, right? Because they're feeling the impact when they see a decades-long increase of their tuition and the strain that has placed on their families, right? Especially when you're talking in kind of Rust Belt areas of the country that once were kind of strongholds of, say, middle-class jobs, like union jobs, industrial jobs, and that has been slowly fading away. So there's certain kind of ways that students are feeling stuff a little bit more receptive to an understanding of the corruption of the people in charge, right? But then talking to, you know, colleagues and talking with other, say, staff members, sometimes it sounds almost like you're like stouting conspiracy theories when you start saying things like, no, look, they tell us that we're in crisis and the sky is falling, but in reality, they're just lying. Right. And what they're doing is they're actually telling a story to us that is convenient for them. And when you get the question, I mean, I got a really good question from this lawyer. It was actually Colleen Bradley. You've probably seen some of the stuff I've been putting out about this. But Colleen Bradley, she blew the whistle at Westchester University a few years back about the deceptive accounting practices that the university was going through. And it was exactly what was happening at my university, at Kutztown University, and across the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education system, right? Even at the level of the Harrisburg at the central office, right? So, and she had, and she had the receipt so she could show it. But when, her lawyer asked me in one of the interviews that I had with her, you know, so, well, if the goal, this was kind of off tape, right? He said, well, he's like, if they're not really in crisis, right? If they really have money, right? Well, then shouldn't you be happy? And I'm like, no, you got to understand. They're lying to state legislators and they're lying to us and they're lying to students. And he said, well, then what's their game? Right. And I think his initial perspective was like, you know, faculty are making out for this. And he's really, wait a minute, you're telling me that they're using the same story to the bludgeon you? I'm like, you're damn right. I said, and that's what they do. And he said, well, what's the point? And I'm like, power and control.
Yes.
And that's it.
Absolutely.
It has to do with them taking a vision, which they've been concocting in their kind of like, you know, closed rooms that they want to come out. And they've had to kind of slowly roll it out. And now it seems like they have an opportunity to, you know, the language that they use here in Pennsylvania is to transform higher education. And now they could do it in one fell swoop, which is exactly what disaster capitalism is about.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's one of the things that we see happening even at you know, University of Cincinnati. So much like I've heard you on the podcast before, discuss how there's on-book and off-book budgeting and accounting. It seems to be that way here at UC. In a recent faculty senate meeting, Bob Ombach, who is the bigwig when it comes to finances at UC, came out and said, look, we've got, if you think of it as a fraction, the denominator here is $750 million budget that we use. And that's not true. The university actually has a budget of $1 billion that they can use, with another $35 million that is earmarked because of, you know, it's a federal fund, go to a specific type of project, or it's a donation from an alumni or a donor, and it has to go to those places so the money can be utilized by the university. But yeah, that's happening. And it's currently happening in a way that, again, like you're saying, is just there to scare people, to put them into panic mode, to make them cower and not say, wait a minute, let's check this stuff out. Now, the only reason we know at UC is because the AAU chapter at UC is very strong and has been very strong for a number of years. It's a collective bargaining chapter, which means that it's what most people would see as a traditional union. We have a collective bargaining agreement, which means we also have a staff that we hire that is their job is to watch the administration. And most of them are lawyers as well. And we also have a really strong tradition of shared governance. And so we actually have really really high participation in the union. So our treasurer, who found this information out, which unfortunately his name escapes me at the moment, he's a political science professor at the Clifton, at the Uptown campus, as we call it, the main campus there, what most people would see as the University of Cincinnati. And he was digging, and he said, look, I went through the public documents. That's not the budget. It's not $750 million. They have $1 billion. They're setting us up to see this as this moment of fear, you know, and so that's exactly what's going on, is this idea of power and control and continue to use this as an excuse to raise tuition, which is a big problem for a lot of us in the AUP, especially those of us who work in the regional colleges, because we believe in open access education and we believe in affordable, accessible, financially accessible education. When you see these sorts of tactics, all that is setting them up to do is to say, hey, look, it's not our fault. The administration is saying this. And we have to raise your tuition because of these costs that have gone up. And then on the flip side, whether they mean to or not, and again, I tend to think they do. I know it's my subject position. But, you know, when it comes around to the contract time, that also hinders people from being really striving and radical, because what the university likes to do in the administration is say, oh, by the way, you know, these are the budgets, and here's where a lot of that pay goes to professors. A lot of that budget is going to professor salary and professor healthcare, vision, dental, those sorts of things. And so there's even been hit pieces recently in Forbes that are dealing with California. And they're talking about these sort of public, the reason that there's such a budget crisis now in California is because of public employee unions and the public employees there. And they talk about
and
like
their pensions and their retirement and their benefits, right? Yep, exactly.
Exactly. And what they do is they reshape. They use this as a moment for their moment of delivery to reshape even the field of what we understand as discussion of what's possible in reality. Because what they're saying without saying it, they make it seem as if the state is on the line to pay that pension. And it's like, wait, no, the employees paid that pension. The employees paid for that health care. They paid their fair share every month of their check for 20 years. And, you know, if the state is now in a problem with that, that's their fault, because we all had negotiators who all have law degrees walk in, hash stuff out, and now they're legally obligated to do that, right? Unless they're going to call for some sort of force majeure, which most institutions or most states can't do after the fact like that, not without some really big changes. There's no way out of that. And and it's really just this, again, it's weird and it does sound like conspiracy theory, like you're saying. However, this is how these things spin, and they suddenly have a life unto their own. And this sort of talk, this writing becomes part of this ecology of how we see the situation in front of us. So it goes from being just the administration at one university to writers who are, let's say, more conservative and writing for, obviously, Forbes magazine, which is going to be more conservative and more financially, focused on bottom lines and neoliberal economics, because that's just the way that corporations see the world now and thinking quarterly. And they present it that way. And much like you're saying in the intro, it is Thatcher. There is no other way. This is the future.
No, I agree 100%. And I think that, you know, what I find that, you know, one of the most difficult things to do when it comes to kind of organizing and pushing back on that is to deal with how embedded the narrative has been about austerity, right? I mean, because if you think about it, a lot of, you know, when the right wing first started on its, you know, 40 plus year trajectory of kind of building out institutions that would support this kind of, you know, market fundamentalism position, that would support this neoliberal kind of agenda. You know, neoliberalism almost seems kind of like middle of the road at this point, compared with the, you know, kind of like Mad Max vision of the world that that the folks in charge now have. But I mean, but that whole idea that one, you know, I mean, think about what the recipe is. Number one is that government bad, right? Government steals from us. So therefore, we should make the government less kind of part of our lives. We should remove like a regulation to allow the market to solve our problems, right? And then when there's a crisis, the market is no longer something that is controlled by people. It is something that is a force of nature by itself. So if it's a force of nature, then there's nothing that you can do, right? And so then the only solution is, because there's no money, right? Because there's just nothing we can do, then we have no choice but to work harder, to work longer, to give up, right? To hand back, right? And if the past 40 years really has been as a steady march forward about students giving back in terms of like paying more tuition and students' families paying more tuition, of faculty having their class sizes increase, of having their workload increase, of having their benefits being cut. And this is happening, I mean, this is just from the vantage point of higher education, but this is happening right across the country in every single occupation, right? And now we see that kind of process of de-skilling, a kind of outsourcing, and then throwing our hands up and say, well, there's nothing that we could do, so I guess that we're going to have to bring in the machines. We're going to have to bring in the kind of like the graders, that we're going to have to bring in the kind of academic piecework as a way to make up for these gaps. And the hard part of that kind of narrative that has been so ingrained in, you know, every single nightly news program, right? Every single time that you hear in a, say, the presidential debates, when somebody comes up with a proposal, the immediate question is, how are you going to pay for that? Right? I mean, it's the same logic that we're at that balance sheet. But what we're kind of, what we've uncovered here, and say, obviously, over the years of kind of looking into this, and as exactly as you're talking about out in Ohio, and as people are looking at across the country, is budgets, and the budget is really a political mechanism to accomplish particular ends. And if the goal is to maximize kind of academic rigor and experience and fostering kind of like learning, then you're going to find a budget that is going to privilege those things. Right. And then you're going to find in a budget like this one, you say, no, we have to kind of deal with student as consumer. What are you going to do? You're going to privileging things like beautifying your campus. Right. And making it like investing in PR firms or bringing in outside consultants to talk about how to better message about your university. Right. Those are different models of the way the world works. But those are still either one of those models, whether we're investing in academic rigor or we're investing in the PR model of higher education, though, and we put together a budget, that's still a story about what we want and what we project. What you start comparing that to, exactly as you just put out there, and we had a guy come in here, Howard Bunce has came into Kutztown, and he does this stuff. He's up at Eastern Michigan University to do an analysis of Kutztown University's budget and some Poshi as a whole. And what he says is like, look, budgets are bullshit. Right? They're just stories. Budgets are bullshit. What you want to know are the actuals, right? The actual numbers that are being reported. Right. And they are required by law to submit that information. You just have to need to know how to do it. And that sounds exactly what like the guy you were talking about, right? The treasurer up at Cincinnati kind of uncovers. Like, let's look at what the money is actually on hand. And when you look at that, you suddenly realize that, oh my God, they have a hell of a lot more money than they've ever told us. Right. I'll still remember the time when I walked on, you know, right, when they were proposing, the Governor Corbett here in Pennsylvania was proposing a 50% cut to higher education in the state of Pennsylvania. And then all the universities were forced to report back their actual numbers. And we were being told at our local campus that Kutztown University was $6 million in the hole. And then we find out that, no, they reported their actuals and they were actually $29 million in surplus. Right. So it was complete, utter lie that was being used to accomplish it. And we got our university president to admit that, sure enough, yep, that's what he did. And he'd do it again. Right.
Right.
And this is the kind of story that we're living with, and getting people to see that that's where the money is, and it's these people that are making choices to destroy this you know, really gem of public higher education in this country.
Absolutely. You know, that's one of the things that is really striking going back to Ohio University, is the reason that those regional campuses were started. And this is a sort of a, I believe it comes out of the Great Society program, by LBJ. When they said, look, we want to make education more accessible, in Ohio, the choice was, instead of creating just separate colleges that existed and were more affordable, they created, you know, they went to those mostly, at the time, mostly supported by public taxes and some of them big land grant schools, and said, hey, look, you need to start campuses or colleges that work within the university, that go out and go into these rural areas. Because Blue Ash now is a pretty sizable suburb of Cincinnati, where I am. But at the same time, it was originally designed when that was basically the country. And it was like, right, you're going to offer associate's degrees, you're going to offer tech degrees, you're going to offer vo-tech degrees. And that idea was that we're expanding education, that we're democratizing education, we're making, and it was open access, so we're making education as open as possible to as many people as possible. For a lot of folks who work at my campus, that's a big thing. And we really believe in that mission, and we believe in that founding mission. And then on the dual side is also the idea that, you know, that it sells to other people outside of our campus, is that we're also preparing people to be good citizens as well as prepare them for the workforce. And when you start to do things and say, like what you pointed out with the idea of beautification and bringing in advisors of new buildings, and you get away from that academic mission, which is, by the way, where Ohio campuses are always cutting at this point. Like in your intro, you talk about sports. Almost every Ohio campus, and even recently it's been pointed out that Ohio State, after an outside review, is also running deficits now. They can't afford their own football program, which is, you know,
wild
news to everybody here.
Right.
You get away from that more democratic message. And because you pull from those sources, you start to give less and less to those regional campuses. And it literally becomes not just an issue of access, but it becomes an issue of like, what are you owed? right? As a citizen who lives in a democracy, or even if you're not a citizen, when you're working through citizenship, you're an immigrant, whatever, what can America provide for you? And what do we envision as a better version of ourselves? You start taking away from those things when you say, like, this is going to be a premier destination school, which is literally how the former administrative, the former sports AD here at University of Cincinnati, who I believe his name was like Tom Bond or something. He's at the University of Southern California now, so he's already moved on. But in an interview where he went head to head with the, well, not head to head, where he was discussing things, let's say, with the Ohio State chapter president, John McNay, who's a professor of history at the University of Cincinnati, on the local NPR associate, WVXU, he literally used that language, like, we are striving to make, and we're doing our part in athletics, to make UC a destination school, someplace that students want to come to. And again, it's that mindset of neoliberalism that's seeping out and poisons everything. Instead of saying, like, let's focus on academic mission. Yes, we all enjoy sports. Let's have that. It's more of, we have to run deficits because this is part of that larger plan to draw students in, as if, like, this is a destination or a vacation stop, and not necessarily a place of higher learning. And that we have to compete, that there's this competition, that we have to go against Ohio State and Ohio University. He actually mentions Ohio State, I should say, not Ohio University, but UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles, and talking about when our football team lines up, these are the things that make us a destination campus. And so it's a total shift in the worldview at all levels about what is the purpose of education? What is the purpose of a public university? And it's really frightening because, again, COVID-19 right now, this pandemic is providing cover to move closer to that vision of, you know, the ceaseless competition, of the idea that we have to get dollars and that we see everything as revenue streams. Students are revenue streams. Professors are revenue producers. You know, everything Mark Bousquet talks about and how the university works, it's coming closer and closer to reality.
Yeah, that's about it, I'll tell you. So we're just about coming up to a break. And I'll tell you, the one good thing, though, we can leave before the break is that, you know, with it as a destination school, I bet you we could really spin up the kind of Ohio riverboat and casino industry that could drop people off on the shores and the banks of Cincinnati so that they can go to their destination up at UC. That sounds absolutely fantastic. Anyway, this is
Kevin Synergy. Synergy, Kevin.
There you go. It's all coming together now, man. It's all coming. Forget about the floodplains. Forget about climate change. Forget about all that stuff. We're going to bring back the riverboats and casinos. You've seen Ozark. Now you can have it too. So when we come back, we're going to drill down a little bit what's going on at the University of Cincinnati. I'm going to, and some of the stuff that Brian was already starting to talk a little bit about there, is because what does this mean kind of at a kind of a regional campus? And what are the ways that, say, like, I don't even know what you call it, to kind of like the crazy spending on athletics has happened at UC, and some sort of, you know, I don't know, some kind of heroin dream fantasy about the athletic future of that, how that's going to carry us through kind of what's going on there. So this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be back right after this break. I want to remind you, become a member of Raging Chicken by going to patreon.com/RC Press today. We'll be right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. Can you imagine if the earth beneath your hometown caught fire and kept on burning for more than half a century? That is what happened in Centralia, Pennsylvania. And on this day in labor history, the year was 1962. Centralia was a mining town with 2,700 residents built above a rich vein of anthracite coal. It's not entirely certain what started the fire. The town had used an abandoned mine as a landfill. Each spring, they would burn the trash collected during the year. It's thought that the trash burning was not fully extinguished and spread to the mine. Once they realized the extent of the problem, town and state officials tried to stop the fire, but they could not. In 1979, the owner of a gas station in town checked his underground tanks. He found the gasoline had heated up to 172 degrees Fahrenheit. By the early 1980s, sinkholes began to open up around the town. One 12-year-old boy almost perished in one of the sinkholes. Seventh grader Tom Dombowski was crossing his neighbor's yard when the earth beneath him opened up. He fell 8 feet. Todd was rescued by his cousin before he plummeted further into the 150-foot hole. In 1984, the government began relocating town members to other locations. 8 residents fought the relocation and won permission to stay on the burning landscape until they passed away. Today, Centralia burns underground and is but a pile of rubble and abandoned houses on the surface. The asphalt of the town's roads have deep gashes and white smoke rising from the cracks. It's estimated the former mining town may continue to burn for another 2 centuries.
Some refuse to leave a place their family.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Sweet home for walls of men.
Welcome back to Raging Chickens Out to Coop podcast. Yes, we are here talking with Brian Bailey today out of the University of Cincinnati's Blue Ash College. And we've been talking a little bit about, you know, kind of what's important in higher education. And it's clear where the priorities are at University of Cincinnati right now. So, for example, they got a new coach, right, not too long ago, last year, right, by the name of John Brannan, right? He came to the University of Cincinnati via Northern Kentucky, right? And if you know anything about that area of the country, that's just kind of across the river, right? I mean, it's not that far, right? It's kind of across the river or so. And they brought him aboard, right? And they value this guy, right? Clearly, right? Got an athletic program, so what do you do? So, well, he gets an annual compensation of $1.5 million a year, which includes a base salary of $250,000. And it's part of a 6-year deal worth $9 million, not including potentials. What are those potentials, you'll say? Oh, well, just don't worry about it. So you got little things like this. If he gets, you know, an NCAA tournament appearance for his basketball coach, right? Well, he gets $50,000. Gets to the Sweet 16, he gets $150,000. Elite 8, $250,000. Final 4, $300,000. Win the national championship, $400,000. That's freaking awesome. Even if they get regular 21 season wins. I mean, come on. You got to give the guy some incentive, right? Give him a little bit out there. 21 season wins, what do you get? $10,000. 23, 20,000, and on it goes. I mean, here's a guy who's just getting all sorts of kind of like amazing perks. And, you know, if he stays there extra long, if he stays there through this full contract, he even gets more bonuses, right? So I don't know, Brian, I look at this and I'm like, look, obviously, this is where we should be putting our money because we value as a society this kind of labor, right? I mean, the labor of that coach, because without that coach, without that kind of like, you know, our he's not quite a billionaire, but without that kind of guy on the top to, for everything else to trickle down to, I mean, what else is there? I mean, we got to value these people or they're all going to run away, right?
Absolutely. No, I am being so ironic. I know you can't see my face and everything right now, but yeah, you know, it blows my mind. You're looking at places where this is like, you've got such a huge deficit being run at the University of Cincinnati. And it's this constant idea that sports, again, like we said in the last segment, is this draw and it brings people, it makes us a destination. This is not something that's actually, you know, it's not something we can actually do long-term. So many programs in and of themselves are not feasible. They are not sustainable. If you, you know, we can probably include in the show notes, we can take a look at some of the articles that have been written, even just by the local or the school newspaper, the TNR. And it's just clear that we are swimming in red ink because we spend money on these things. And so when you're looking at like the millions of dollars of deficit that just the football program at UC is running, you could actually retool that and send that into scholarships, need-based scholarships for students and pay for 4 years of school, probably a few hundred students. You know, and these again are things that the AUP is pushing really hard because that's what's important to us. Let's make education accessible and affordable. And if it's going to be expensive, let's make something that, you know, we can all live with and we can help students who are, you know, who have that need, who can actually, you know, who actually want to go and have the drive to do the work, to get the degree. Let's get them going. Let's situate them for success. And that's just not something we see, right? And this continues on and spins into those ideas of what the administration wants to do. And that's happening all around Ohio. I mean, so you've got places like, let's say Wittenberg University, right? Mm-hmm. Wittenberg is a small private liberal arts university here in Ohio. I think it's out in Springfield.
Springfield, yep.
Yeah. And so what they've done is they have really really, and this is the administration, right? They have just fallen asleep at the wheel. They haven't fallen asleep at the wheel. Let me take that back. That's just too nice.
It sounds like they put in turbo boosters on their kind of like disaster capitalist machine is what they seem like they've done.
Absolutely. And that's probably the best way to look at it, because, again, if we go back to that idea of this is a worldview, it's a pedagogy that teaches us how to see the world, and then we enact that pedagogy, what ends up happening is you can see like where this, we're again, small private, a Slack, right? I think that's the term that we often use in academia. It's a selective liberal arts college.
Yep.
We're talking, it's pretty small. So through their management's choices, they spent like $30 million on a new athletic center. A new athletic center at a small private liberal arts college in Springfield, Ohio. $30 million on that. They purchased an art museum in Springfield. And the idea that this would be a draw to the campus, would be connected to the campus, would make it a destination campus. It lost money. Hand over fist, it lost money. So they sold it off at a loss, right?
Yep.
And at this point, because they are not a unionized campus, their faculty is not unionized. They don't have a collective bargaining agreement. Wittenberg, they want to eliminate the handbook. And when you're talking about a handbook at a non-organized campus, that's the closest thing you have to a contract. And that's what's scary is when you start thinking about labor. And I know a lot of professors don't like to think about themselves as labor. They think of themselves as white collar. They think of themselves as individuals, much like executives in corporations. Again, Right. Liberalism seeping out to even those of us who don't work in corporate America. But you have to really consider what happens in these situations and how you should really consider organizing, because once you eliminate that contract, what you're then saying, or it's not a contract, excuse me, once you eliminate that handbook, then you basically are just blowing out everything and all the rules. And at that point, the administration makes the decisions about who gets to teach and what's important. Even the ideas of like, what are your working conditions? How much money will you make? What's going to happen with your raises? And if you want to sit there and try to struggle and fight against an entire group of people who are hired and their whole job is to take care of looking at these situations, of playing every angle, of getting the best outcome possible for them, you're going to be in a lot of trouble as somebody who's also trying to teach a lot of classes, do your service work, to basically even try to publish so you can stay stay current in your field, going to conferences. Any of those things that come towards tenure, you're going to be really hard pressed to do that. And that's one of the things that it's really, really stark here in Ohio, like the differences that are happening and how, at campuses, because of COVID-19 and the pandemic, and because of it being used as cover by universities, to start reshaping what's going on when it comes to working conditions. So even when you have someplace like Kent State, which is also suffering through some big issues, the union's been able to say, look, it's an AEP chapter. They said, look, we're going to, we'll go ahead and we'll give you an extension on our current contract so you don't have to deal with any of the pay raises. And then what we'll do is we'll add an extra year on to our next contract. And so that's something that is a classic moment of real shared governance where the administration has to deal with the faculty, and the faculty and the representatives all come together in a shared governance sense. It's like, this is what's best for the university and the people who work here. We're willing to give back, but we expect these things, but we're all concerned about the overall university and the educational academic mission of the university. So that's a great example of why it's important to have, say, like a union, or even in situations where you're looking at, say, let's see here, I'm looking at my notes. If you take a look at, say, like Bowling Green, right? Mm-hmm. Bowling Green decided that their administration decided, like, you know what, we cannot deal with the organized faculty in a way that will get us what we want. So we're going to go after those non-tenure track faculty, contingent, whatever, visiting. It's just this general broad thing they did. And originally they're like, we're just going to chop 60 and just leave them high and dry.
Yep.
And what ended up happening is Bowling Green's, their chapter was able to say, well, no. Right. And they came up with an alternative budget. And what they did is they said, look, you could do these things and you could just only chop 17 NTT employees. And not only that, with the money we've helped you come up with and way to save, you can actually give them a severance package. We can make sure they have the right to recall, the right to go part time if they're willing to go part time instead of teaching full time. So that we have that flexibility, that person still has a job, and we have the flexibility to bring people in for classes that are sections of classes when we taught. And that, you know, that there's this idea also of a bit of healthcare included in that. So that's a very soft landing for those folks who unfortunately have been cut. But again, this is that time where that organized labor, that organized union, that chapter is able to make a difference. And it's something that really I think people need to consider and think about. Because the opposite example, which is outside of Ohio, and maybe a little bit out of our focus, but if you think about, if you read about, Kevin, Missouri West University,
yes.
Mo West is a stone. It's in St. Joseph, Missouri.
Yep.
They are literally cutting everybody.
Yeah, we talked about that on the podcast a couple of weeks back when they were first kind of like coming out with this. And it's like, this is probably the worst case, like the absolute worst case scenario.
Yeah. So I think if you could run, I don't have the specifics, but do you remember like they're cutting like history, philosophy, English,
there's
political science,
sustainability studies, right?
Sustainability studies.
I mean, at the time of climate change, right? You're getting rid of that.
Right.
A theater department. I think you mentioned, I mean, right across the board. If you look at anything that is non, say, corporate or business related, that is at risk at this point.
Yeah. And so they're only keeping those programs. And I actually spent some time in Missouri, and my first son was born in St. Joseph. And so I know where Missouri West is at, Mo West. One of my brothers went to Mo West for a bit. And this is one of those small schools that, again, is reaching out into the heartland, if you want to think of it that way, mm-hmm. of the Midwest. And this is those places, these are those places that Mo West is one of those places that makes education accessible and affordable for a lot of folks. And to go off this complete sort of corporate minded model and say, we're only having certain majors that fit our view of the world. It's amazing that they would do that, because what are you going to do then when things change?
Right.
Like, so sustainability studies, what are you going to do? How are you going to react to that? How are you going to train people for that? When that would be, if you're going with that model, that's actually a pretty good industry, a pretty good line of work to get into if that's what your degree has set you up to do.
Right. And you think about it too, as well, you couple that with what's gone on in our, say, political culture in this country, is if you cut, just use that as an example, like you cut something like sustainability studies, right? Basically what you're also doing is you're cutting off the pipeline of those people that are trained to actually address things like climate change. And if you're in the political sphere and you control a state government, right, from a kind of a right wing perspective where you want to kind of deny that climate change is existing so that you can continue petrodollars kind of flooded in, right? Continue the reliance on fossil fuels in specific industries, right? Then basically what you've done is you created a generation gap of people with the skills that would be able to push back against that. So there's also a kind of long-term effects about being able to cutting off these programs that are designed, especially something like that, which is designed to address real concrete crises that are kind of emerging. And we see the same stuff happening at our federal government when you start gutting things like the CDC. We started gutting things like, you know, kind of like pandemic preparedness programs and form organizations, things of the same kind of stuff. Then you deplete those organizations, you deplete the pipeline of people that are actually going to address it, so that even if you have a sea change that comes back, now it's an uphill battle just to get to the point and be able to respond effectively, right? So there's a power grab even in that goes beyond, say, the university itself, that goes beyond, say, whether or not somebody should have theater or something. And, you know, but it also gets us to questions like, what the hell are we doing, right? I mean, what does it mean to actually be like a human being, to be a citizen, to be a, like, you know, a participant in a culture? I mean, it seems like what we're seeing in these transformations, right, the Missouri West being a perfect example of this, is that we want to train cogs. We want to train people for the needs of the people at the very top. And that is it. And we're going to take away kind of critical thinking. We're going to take away our ability to kind of think beyond the immediate moment. We want people to focus on the needs of the corporations, and the focus on the needs of the immediate kind of bottom line of the, you know, accounting sheet. And that's it.
Yeah, that's something that, again, if we go back to what we've been talking about and you really hit on in the intro, is that the pandemic is cover for these moves. Again, it sounds like conspiracy, but it's not necessarily. It's just these different things that are happening because you have a worldview,
right,
that is informing these choices being made. This is something that we've been struggling at the University of Cincinnati for a while. We operate, the main campus, Clifton, operates under performance budgeting, or PBB. And it was something that was actually created during a time in the aftermath of the Great Recession. And so what ends up happening with PBB is the idea that there's a threshold that every specific college and department has to make, right? Or each college, and therefore it's pushed down each department within that college have to make. And so the threshold is a predetermined budget. And again, it's this idea of going back to the administration and that sort of entitlement and smugness that comes with that, the system that's set up in your favor, where you're saying, this, of course, is going to be what's going to happen in the future. And so what ends up happening is if you don't make that threshold, then you owe the university money. And so here, going back to, I think, what we've already talked about with budgets being fictional, budgets being values made real, like what we're talking about with the last couple of minutes, you were just talking about how there's differences about what is valuable and who is valuable. What ends up happening is this is a way to prioritize that in a really physical, material, embodied way. So, for instance, the Arts of College and the College of Arts and Sciences at the Clifton campus has been making money technically, but because right after the financial meltdown of the Great Recession, there was a dip in their FTEs, they've owed money for like 10 years now. And so the only way within PBB to make money back is through austerity, is you have to either cut your money for your supplies, or you have to cut the number of people who are quote unquote revenue generators, or you have to cut everything basically. It's only through austerity. And so what ends up happening is you've got these stories, and there's this great website put on by students at University of Cincinnati who have gotten really involved, and it's called Boldly Bankrupt, and it plays on the UC idea of Boldly Bearcat. It's one of the slogans that the PR department came up with. So it's Boldly Bankrupt, and hopefully we'll be able to include that link in Definitely. The show notes later.
Just made a note of it.
Good. One of the things that they point out is that or one of the things they make available is a platform through that website for students, faculty, staff to share their experiences with dealing with PBB. And there are student employees who work in the Department of English within the College of Arts and Sciences at the UC Clifton main campus who are giving these stories of like they are bringing their own office supplies in as a student employee to do their job in the office. Some tape. Scotch tape, staples, staplers, those sorts of things. The flip side of that is to say, you know, the university says, well, you can always raise your cap, you know, your classes, right? So especially when you know this and I know this, when you teach composition rhetoric, which is almost always housed in an English department, it's not its own standalone thing. That's a big no-no, right? Like we like to keep, because we do a lot of hands-on work. We're doing, very sort of, intense work with students going back and forth, lots of readings, lots of writings, and lots of projects in progress that we get feedback on. Our professional organization, the Conference on College Communication, Composition and Communication, says the max should be 20. And so that's always their big pushback is like, well, go ahead and let's raise that cap to 23 or 30 or 50. And so what you're constantly getting is that, again, that disaster capitalism you're talking about. Work harder with less. Hire contingent faculty, pay them below living, minimum wage standards to teach these classes, that are huge. And therefore, they don't think about it, but what ends up happening is the outcome is that you don't have best practices when it comes to teaching methodology in the classroom.
And it's got the added bonus, right, of being able to kind of put the onus of blame back on the faculty, right? I'm back on the faculty by saying, well, you're the one who's causing this problem. And I know that, say, for example, at my university, one of the issues that you find that this actually kind of carries over into, say, other faculty and other departments. So we have some departments who were forced, not by our choosing, right? Our union tried to push back against this. And again, we were told, we're talking about the our former university president brought in an outside consultant to determine they're going to build this big classroom building. And then they were going to determine which departments were going to go in there, and not for academic reasons, not based upon current practices in those departments, but based upon what are other schools doing that can fill capacity in those stuff. So you have departments on our campus who are forced to teach a lot of their intro classes in larger classrooms, right? And so now when you see these cuts come back out, you have some of those faculty that are looking to those departments and those departments and those programs that have smaller class sizes and putting the blame on those faculty and those programs. And basically saying, like in our field in composition and rhetoric, you're teaching writing classes, you're teaching small classes. Well, you're not bearing your load, right? You're not kind of being able to, you know, to carry the weight. And because of that, we're negatively impacted. And what the university has done at our university into is that we've had incredibly difficult time recruiting, say people of color, right? When it comes to in our, say, composition rhetoric in the English department, right? And there's a whole bunch of historic reasons to that, as well as the art department, right? And so we have a disproportionate number of people of color that are teaching these large classrooms, right, in other departments. And so now you get this kind of racial tension that kind of gets put on top of that, right? And it's all caused by the fact that the university initially trying to want to separate these things out and put this kind of climate of austerity in there. So I remember having the conversations with other faculty members about saying, like, hey, what if we said, okay, you have to teach a large classroom, they're going to force it, then we should be pushing to have class size equivalents, right? So if you're teaching two classes in like 200 seat auditorium, that should count for two classes, or it should go four classes, right? And so one big class equals two or three smaller classes, right? And then we could break up the loads like that. But again, everybody just wants to point fingers at each other. That's a little bit of a sidetrack, I know, but it's one of those frustrating. You could see that because there's like cascading effects down the road, and just in terms of like what actually happens in terms of how we're able to do our jobs and focus on education. And I always think, like, again, this is more of extreme example, but this is one of the things I always held on to with Frantz Fanon's Wretched of the Earth, right? And he talks about when people are kind of raised in violence, right? Raised in a crisis of violence, then that is the way that they learn to kind of to express themselves. Right. So it shouldn't be a surprise that when people are fighting to resist, that they're actually going to have this horizontal violence against each other, because that's what they've come up against. And that logic, the idea that what you're going to learn the tools of the oppressor. Right. And then that is going to be one of the ways that starts to express itself against each other. This has been this is the age old story of divide and conquer. Right. In a very real situation in which, you know, our public institutions are being gutted. So, I mean, the layers of impact of these kind of policies is absolutely insane. And I keep on coming back to what you said when we started this segment here. We were talking about the value of a union and the value of a contract is the reason why that the contract becomes so important, right? It's not only because, yes, you're guaranteed these steps and things are more transparent. But the thing is that it's not about, say, persuasion about who makes the best argument and who uses the best words, right? It's about a legal binding contract that the reason why in one school that has a union, they don't have like all of a sudden 40% cut of their faculty members. And at a different school, they have, 40% cut of your faculty members because you don't have a union. It's not because the people in the union environment kind of like argued better. Or they had, you know, better kings at the head of their university, right? There wasn't the generous ruler of that university. No, it had to do that there were restrictions and there were constraints that were put on not the faculty members, certainly, but also the administration's ability to carry out their will. And so they have to go through a process and they have to slow it down. And it doesn't just become a reactive move that basically allows them to say, we have a crisis, like, therefore we have to cut, gut, and punish. No, we have to slow things down and we have to go through a process. And that is such an incredible value of being in a unionized environment.
It is. And it's also a way, again, and let's say I'm offering an open hand, since we're doing a lot of rhetorical theory here. I'm offering the open hand instead of the closed fist to the folks who are on the fence about their union, especially now that, you know, you've got people who don't have to pay fair share dues if they're at a unionized campus. You know, again, you should really participate in the union. If you also want to keep in mind that the academic mission of any university is actually its core mission. All this other stuff we're talking about, buildings, great facilities, you know, great student rec centers, athletic centers, you know, sports as a way to be like a destination for people who aren't even going to college, but just coming in and spending money on campus so they can watch Bearcat football. All of that is, it pushes us away from the academic mission. And one of the biggest problems that I have and my chapter has with what we're dealing with PBB, which has not rolled out to the regional campuses yet, but will in the next year or so, that it is this way to constantly look at and use those metrics of neoliberalism that only austerity works, or only, you know, packing in with the lowest overhead possible, packing in students at the lowest overhead possible, meaning who's teaching the class, is what is the way to move forward. And the reason they do that is much like the contracts we were talking about at the beginning of the segment, is because it's easy to measure. Because, you know, really what they should be doing is looking at, like, much like a professional organization does, ours, but others in general, like when it comes to history or whatever, whatever discipline, how are we measuring students' learning? How are they doing in this environment? Are we really reaching that core academic mission? Are students learning? Are students learning the skills they'll need to do well in other classes as well as anything they do outside of the university? And that just doesn't happen in PBB because right. that's not the value. And that's one of the things that is just really frustrating for the AAUP in general, but the AAUP UC chapter specifically, is that we're pushing back against this all the time. And again, it does value certain things because guess what? If you're operating under PBB and you're at the Linder College of Business, which is the big business school at the University of Cincinnati. It comes from the Linder family, which is quite powerful and does a lot of philanthropic things and donates money. But again, PBB is set up and it's in their wheelhouse because they can go out and they can do advising. They can go out and get corporate co-ops going. Or if you're, say, with something like DAP, which is the big design program here, again, you can go out and work with PG&E, which is huge here. Right. Or, you know, there's all these different corporate campuses out here, and you can do these partnerships. You know, so again, the things that reach out and can be monetized and commodified are valued, are prized, are a way that you can gain PBB, so that way you make the money and you don't lose money and you're not in debt as a college or as a department within that college. But if you're in the more traditional liberal arts, it's hard. Right? It's really difficult because what are you going to do, right? Who's hiring? I mean, I think it would be great if they were hiring those of us who teach Red Comp, and it's like, we would become like the sophist and we would be going out and, you know, teaching for these powerful individuals for a pretty good fee. But that's not reality. And that's not what happens now. And the way that we look at communication and writing and language is so opposite of what is favored in corporations. Just by the fact that we tend to be more ethical, you know, they're not going to hire us to do that kind of work. You know, who's going to hire a history professor to do this sort of, you know, large scale advising that's a long term sustainable project, right? That just doesn't happen, you know? And so again, you start to see these values put into place in really material embodied ways. And this is what I think I would like to stress also, is like, this is why this isn't conspiracy theory, because you can actually see these things happen,
right?
In a way that we really appreciate as a culture and society, which is, dollars and cents and the cutting of programs because they don't make those threshold goals. So, you know, it's really difficult, you know, to really just not go overboard on, like, organize, push back. It's not easy, but once it's in place, it can protect you. It protects your colleagues, but most importantly, it protects your students, because our working conditions are their learning conditions. And that's what we really want to stress as a union and as a chapter in particular at UC. Like, we are really concerned about students, and students need to get the best they can get out of us because they're only here for a few years and it's costing them so dearly in so many cases.
Amen, brother. I hear you. Well, listen, I've been keeping you longer than I thought, so I want to take a quick break, and we want to come back, and I want to give a little beer recommendations to ply us with our self-medication for COVID disaster capitalism, as it were.
Okay.
Yeah, but so we'll be back right after this break, and we're going to hear there's some thoughts that Brian's got for this, and I'm sure that I'm going to be calling you back, Brian, to have you back on the show, because this is going to be a developing situation all summer long, and then I think that we're really have to gear up for kind of a major fight back. So we'll be back right after this with today's last call, and we're going to get some beer and kind of hope recommendations from Brian. We'll be back right after this. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. For the past 7 years, Raging Chicken Press has brought pull-no-punches, progressive reporting and commentary to the interwebs. Our long-form investigative pieces, stories that no access journalist wants to touch, or rollicking weekly podcasts strive to advance progressive movements and perspectives rooted in the struggles happening across the country,
or down the street. We've broken national stories and caused our share of discomfort in the halls of power. If we want a progressive future, we need progressive media. And you can help support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today. Become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. We need to make sure to keep the movement in the media and the media in the movement. Best way you can do that is to become a member of Raging Chicken today by going to patreon.com/rcpress. Thank you for your energy, your encouragement, and your support. Keep up the fight.
Back to Raging Chicken's Out to Coop podcast. It's today's last call here with Brian Bailey, right, from University of Cincinnati, Blue Ash College. So we thought that, you know, since we got Brian coming in here from the Cincinnati area, that we might kind of have some different recommendations for you. Maybe someday we're actually going to have this quarantine kind of broken out, so we'll actually be able to safely visit people in other parts of the country. So if you're down there, but you know, just kind of anything that we would look out that would kind of add to our, say, beer recommendations, and then we'll get a little kind of like addition to the bucket of hope at the end. So Brian, as you know, it's like I live in Perkasie, where it's Free Will Brewing here. I'm always kind of championing their stuff. But I'm just kind of curious. And I'm, like I said, I'm wearing this kind of Rheingeist brewing hat because I remember when you first moved out there, you told me about Rheingeist, right? It's in the over the Rhine area of Cincinnati. I went to Miami, Ohio, and I'd spent a lot of time in Cincinnati. And kind of before all the kind of over the Rhine kind of redevelopment really started happening, there was some original stuff there. But Cincinnati has been Cincinnati in the area has got a long, long brewing tradition, right? I mean, again, there were German was the primary language that was used in public schools in Cincinnati until like the 20th century. And there's a rich brewing tradition here. And it's been kind of cool to see some of the rebirth of, say, the craft brewing in the area and around there. And and again, not to say that you've got recommendations that have to come from Cincinnati, but I'd love to hear kind of your kind of go-tos or kind of suggestions for people that are looking for something new.
If you're in Cincinnati, and this also applies to what's called Greater Cincinnati, which is the sort of rural suburb areas that are outside of Cincinnati, usually within a 20-30 minute drive up and down the 71 or 75. These are my recommendations. I would start though first with Rheingeist. Rheingeist is great. It's a great brewery. It's got a great pub attached to it if you want to go in. Parking's a little hinky at times because it does get crowded, especially on the weekends. It's quite popular. Great beer selection all around. In particular, if you can get their seasonal stuff, like they have a Scotch ale that's pretty good, and they've got a couple IPAs on tap that are just phenomenal. So if you get a chance, I would totally recommend Rheingeist. Mad Tree Brewing is pretty big around here too. I want to say that they also have a lot of very, very good. They've got one called Lift, which is a Belgian white style, I believe. And my favorite is their Psychopathy. I always mispronounce it, but think of it as Psychopathy, but then it's the hops in there, you know? So it's like, it's an exceptionally hoppy IPA. It's one of the better IPAs, which, as craft brewing catches up, it's really hard to find good, as craft brewing and small brewing becomes more and more popular, there are a lot of breweries that are putting out IPAs, and there are some really way off the mark, different quality sort of IPAs out there.
Totally.
Because unfortunately, IPA is a style because there's so much hops. So you created a bad pilsner. It's like, well, throw a bunch of, hops in there and just cover it. Right. Hops. It covers everything. But, their Psychopathy is above and beyond. It's a really great, beer. I've also started drinking, this weekend I had Saunders, which is out in Mason, Ohio. And Saunders is really good. I'm having their Belgian wheat style. It's got a hint of citrus to it. Very nice, very, very, very nice session beer. It's only got like a 5.4, I think, ABV. So it's not bad if you want to sit down and have a few. They've also got a great lineup. And again, it's a great, like the tradition brewing you're talking about. They've got a great brewery with like a really nice outdoor area. You can go in, you can step in. It's got a great pub attached to it. It's really built on that idea of being, to go back to that phrase, a destination spot in the area. So that's a great one. Christopher Moreland's out here as well. They always do pretty well, pretty good brews.
Christopher who?
I think it's Christopher Moreland.
Moreland?
I haven't had them in a while. Moreland, maybe? Mm-hmm. I haven't had them in a bit, but I would recommend them. I have had them because I went out to a restaurant and it was suggested to me by a server. It was actually their IPA was really good. They also had a brown ale that was really good, I believe. And then my big favorite, which is not in Ohio, and again, Ohio is a huge tradition of brewing. There are a lot of breweries out here, just small breweries that are in these towns that you wouldn't even expect.
Yeah.
Huge brewing tradition here. But one of my favorites is always New Belgium Brewing Company, which is out in Colorado.
I've got actually one of their like art glasses, right? They're they've got some great stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's employee owned and operated. Yep. And they use a majority of or they try to use as much sustainable sort of alternative power as they can, so river and wind. So it's always hard for me not to give them a plug. So I've never had a bad beer from them, even in the winters when they put out their 15, I think it's 1551 or 1554.
I love Black that Ale. Beer. I love that.
That's beer. A great beer,
that's
right?
That's like my favorite of all of their stuff. That is my go-to.
Yeah. And if you get a chance, they've got a new Belgian white as well that's pretty good. And that would be my suggestion. If you've got a little bit of extra cash, you can also check out Pollinger, Pollinger's Hefeweizen. It's a wheat. It's great. It's you know, classic German brewing at its best.
There you go. Fantastic. Well, look, there's going to be links to all the stuff that you just heard Brian say. It's going to be links in the show notes today. So don't worry if you didn't catch it right now. You don't have to necessarily go back and rewind right at this moment. You can go look in the show notes and you'll have links directly to those different breweries and to the beers. So, man, that's like the best freaking range of suggestions that we've had in a while. So this is great, man. Thanks. All right, so in the midst of the here we are, we've got a little bit of a pep in our step now because we're thinking about drinking beer, got summertime coming, all this. So let's talk about the hope bucket. So if you had to leave us here today with a little something to kind of add into our bucket of hope, going direction in the midst of the struggles that we kind of unquestionably face kind of going forward, say in the higher education area and move forward, let me leave that to you. What would you put in that bucket?
Well, first we'll start off and we'll work towards the light. So we're going to start dark. I'm going
to
bring it back.
I always like to do it. You start in dark.
Start dark. That's there, right. You, well, you know, when you spend enough time in Syracuse, eventually that's
there
just
you go.
See.
Right. Exactly.
Winters are long there, folks.
Close to my soul.
What we're dealing with here at UC is we're seeing where they're actually saying, hey, our budget is $750 million. And we're reaching the end of that budget. And really, that's not true. Through public access records, I think as we've gone over before, the union has discovered that it's actually a $1 billion budget. This is what they can actually spend. One of the things that they're also doing is, again, by doing that off-counting, off-the-book sort of accounting, they're also projecting that there will be a 20% reduction in the state money that comes from the Ohio state government when it comes to supporting public institutions. And even then, they're also taking a look at saying things like, again, going back to that 20% cut, and then talking about cutting where appropriate, and saying like, we're going to have all these budget shortfalls, that enrollment's going to be down. And again, they're constantly saying these things. And the cuts they're forcing at us only come from the academic side. When the irony is of PBB is that the athletics department is not run by PBB, so therefore they can run a deficit.
Right.
There are no cuts coming to their budget, as well as I would assume what they do every year is they do an accounting trick to take money from the general fund that's just meant for academics, and they go ahead and they then therefore make sure that budget shortfall is always caught up. And we've got things like, President Pinto, who's the president of the university, is willing to take a 10% pay cut, which means that, you know, $74,000 is going back to the university. But keep in mind, at 10%, that means that his salary is essentially $740,000 a year.
Man, that's going to hurt. That's going to hurt. What's he going to do?
Yeah.
What's he going to do?
What's he going to do? What's he going to do with the house and the car and everything he's already provided as it is? And let's just, for comparison, let's keep in mind that Governor DeWine, the governor of the great state of Ohio, only makes $153,000 a year. And that doesn't even count the people who are on the board and the sorts of folks who are making $500,000 a year because they're involved in things like you know, accessing funds. They're the outreach groups that go out and get money. The positive side to all of this is that the way that you push back and the way that we've been able to push back is to have these sorts of meetings on places like Zoom, which Kevin and I are using today, as a union. And we have these huge town halls where we've got hundreds of people participating. And because we have that union, because we have our union, and because we've got people who are tasked with paying attention to this, they come and make these reports and they check their records and they present the information to us and we're making choices. So the thing is the positive, if you stay awake and if you organize and if you work together, and it's not perfect, but it's a lot better than not having a union, you can push back and you can make things happen. One of the things that I really like about this is that, again, it goes back to this idea of organization and all of us working together, but also you've got student groups that are on board as well. And so it's totally separate from the union. You've got Boldly Bankrupt, which is actually a conglomeration of several student groups who are also seeing the problems with PBB and talking about how it affects their education, as well as their pocketbooks, essentially, when it comes to being students at the University of Cincinnati. And that's the bright spot, is that as long as you organize, as long as you pay attention, as long as you reach out to other groups, you can always push back. And that's something I would really stress, is that folks just do the work and know that at the same time, no one's asking you to be this hero. They're asking you to participate, to do some work, to pay attention, to contribute where you can, and then out to reach out to folks. This isn't new. It's not something that's not been done before. It's classic union work. You reach out, you work with other groups, and you form coalitions where you can. And this is the way to push back. And that's what we've been able to do and stave off any sort of major cuts that the administrations want to do here at the University of Cincinnati.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, I'll tell you what, thank you so much for joining us today, Brian. Man, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the insight and the kind of perspective and the beer recommendations. I won't gonna lie, but and a perfect way to kind of close this out today. A matter of fact, I'm going to change our normal outro song. I think I've got the perfect outro song after that little kind of contribution to the bucket of hope that we got moving forward, Forward for Resistance. This is Compliments of My Daughter Scout. Thank you for all tuning into us. Thank you, Brian, for joining us today. I'm definitely going to be bugging you to come back throughout the summer as we see the developments here. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. I want to kind of leave you here. Compliments of My Daughter Scout.
We are the union.
We are the union.
The mighty, mighty union.
Mighty, mighty union.
Everywhere
we go,
everywhere we go,
people want to know
who we are, so we tell them, we are the union,
we are the union.
The